Turn your tax refund into better sleep at Mattress Warehouse. Save up to $850. Plus, get a free adjustable base and enjoy our exclusive lifetime price guarantee. Only at Mattress Warehouse. Because we're more than a mattress store. We're Mattress Warehouse.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Now, I will just tell you that this particular book has been sat on my shelf for years and years now, and I'm sure I bought it at some secondhand bookstore many years back, obviously intending to get round to it, and this has given me the perfect opportunity to do so. So, by all means, let's cue the Kate Bush and get on with it, shall we? So, because this is my first time reading it, I will just say out of the gate that I can already tell that this is a novel that is well worthy of its reputation, but also a novel that's definitely going to reward you for numerous readings. You can tell that there are so many subtle details weaved into the text, and it's really remarkable. Honestly, from the beginning of the story, I was genuinely hooked by it. And another thing as well that I think just kept me so engaged in the tale was the fact that it was so different to the story that I was actually expecting. Because you have all of these Hollywood films that kind of paint the relationship between Kathy and Heathcliff as a classic romance in many ways, because that's obviously the type of story that Hollywood want to tell. But I think actually that's to do a real disservice to the type of relationship that Emily Bronte is putting to the page here, because it really caught me by surprise. It's far from romantic, really. It's very, very, very toxic, very destructive. And also as well, just to say that relationship between Heathcliff and Kathy, which you see over and over again on the film, is actually only the first half of the novel as well. This is a story of generations and how what happened to that generation obviously goes on to impact the second generation through the cycle of revenge and healing and all these sorts of questions. And so it's a really ambitious story, and it's made all the more wonderful having it set seeped in this gothic mystique, you know, as it takes place on the Yorkshire Moors, which if you've never been to, by the way, I will, you know, advise you to go and check them out, because they are genuinely breathtaking. And I suppose another thing as well is that when you are living a life that rural, as Emily Bronte did for much of her life, then the moors today will be very, very similar, right? You'll still be able to go out and see nothing but them, but nature, for miles and miles around. They are truly extensive and a real marvel in their own right. And so it's automatically a fantastic place to stage a story in. And yeah, it was very impressive. So let's begin by talking a little bit, shall we, about the Brontes, the Bronte sisters, and Emily in particular. One thing to note is that they were, as was standard for the time, a very large family. Their father was an Irishman, and their mother was Cornish, a daughter of a Cornish merchant. And when Emily was very, very young, they came up to Yorkshire to settle there, because her father had basically obtained a position as a curate at the local church in Haworth, where Emily lived for most of her life and where the Bronte Museum now exists today. Most of what we know about Emily comes from her sister Charlotte, who outlived her, though didn't really go on to have a very extensive life of her own. And that really is something that defines the story of the Bronte sisters. They're constantly surrounded by death and sadness and, you know, a grim nature. And especially when you see into Emily's letters and the things that she was writing, you see actually that far from sort of like a pantheistic love and just, you know, some sort of hippie out in nature just sitting under the trees, you see a darker mind at work. There is something truly gothic in her very view of the world and a cynicism towards nature itself, but still with a reverence for its power. And Emily and Charlotte and Anne and all the rest of them, they lost two of their sisters very, very young to typhus when they were at a boarding school nearby because of the unsanitary conditions there. And you see something very similar happen in Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, actually, where someone dies at the school. But through all of this, the Bronte sisters are very well documented, and also we don't really know a great amount about Emily herself. She seems to have been the quietest. She was also definitely the one that stayed around Yorkshire the most out of the three of them. When Wuthering Heights was first published back in 1847, it received a very mixed reception, to say the least. People were very taken aback by how dark the characters were, by how none of them seemed particularly redeemable. They basically said that Emily, under the pen name of Ellis Bell, had just misunderstood literature and had, that it was quite a clumsy piece of work. And so it's a shame that she only lived another year after its publication and passed away at the age of 30 from tuberculosis. And she never actually got to see the fame that her novel would go on to have. Also, just another thing to say is that in addition to Charlotte and Anne as her sisters, she did also have one brother who survived into adulthood, and that was Branwell Bronte. And we see from him the actual painting of the three sisters together. And it's definitely one of the most important things that we have in terms of getting an idea about who they were as people. So I've decided for the purpose of Wuthering Heights that because it is split so perfectly down the middle, with the first half of the story taking up Cathy and Heathcliff and that generation, and then the second part taking up characters like little Cathy, her daughter, and Linton, and some of the other characters who are brought into it, that we're going to split it into two parts, because even though it is a pretty standard length, I mean, I've got it here in 245 pages, it's pretty dense. And though I, you know, whenever I do the storytelling aspect of Chronicles, I always script it and, you know, to try and give it a richer texture, there is simply so much that happens in Wuthering Heights, so many little moments, that it's genuinely impossible to put them all in. So I'm going to go through the story now, I'll tell you it all, and then we will talk about the first half of Wuthering Heights. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England, I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthrope's heaven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are of such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed towards him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further in his waistcoat as I announced my name. These words are the account of Mr. Lockwood, a man of society, just moved to the rural grandeur of Yorkshire. He is a respectable man of unimpeachable manners, but such sociability is wasted on his brooding, sinister landlord, Mr. Heathcliff, who lives at the oppressive residence of Wuthering Heights. Mr. Lockwood's visit there introduces him to a dour collection of characters. Joseph, an austere and aged servant. Hareton, a strong young man of limited learning. Zillah, a hardy gossip serving as a housekeeper. And a young woman of the most grave disposition. Mr. Lockwood learns that her name is Catherine Heathcliff, and that she was once married to Mr. Heathcliff's son, who has since died. Mr. Lockwood is forced to sleep at Wuthering Heights for the night, as the moors are mantled by darkness, and there is no guide to spare. The hospitality is cold, and in that restless night he sees the name Catherine scratched into the window ledge. Resting near it is Catherine's childhood diary, and Mr. Lockwood begins to browse through it. Earnshaw, Linton, Heathcliff, all of these family names follow on in various etchings. The house is haunted by memory and malice and regret, and perhaps something more. Mr. Lockwood begins to dream, and in that dream he attends a sermon at a chapel, but is defensive when the pastor accuses him of sin. The congregation descends into a cacophony of clubs and violence until the dream is shattered, as branches from a nearby tree smash through the window, waking Mr. Lockwood, as he recounts. I muttered, knocking my knuckles through the glass and stretching an arm out to seize the importunate branch, instead of which, my fingers closed on the fingers of a little ice-cold hand. The intense horror of nightmare came over me. I tried to draw back my arm, but the hand clung to it, and a most melancholy voice sobbed. Let me in. Let me in. Who are you? I asked, struggling meanwhile to disengage myself. Catherine Linton, it replied shiveringly. Why did I think of Linton? I had read Earnshaw 20 times for Linton. I'm come home. I'd lost my way on the moor. As it spoke, I discerned obscurely a child's face looking through the window. Terror made me cruel, and finding it useless to attempt shaking the creature off, I pulled its wrists onto the broken pane and rubbed it to and fro till the blood ran down and soaked the bedclothes. Still it wailed, "Let me in," and maintained its tenacious gripe, almost maddening me with fear. "How can I?" I said at length. "Let me go, if you want me to let you in." The fingers relaxed. I snatched mine through the hole, hurriedly piled the books up in a pyramid against it, and stopped my ears to exclude the lamentable prayer. I seemed to keep them closed above a quarter of an hour, yet the instant I listened again, there was a doleful cry moaning. "Begone!" I shouted. "I'll never let you in, not if you beg for 20 years. "It is 20 years, mourned the voice. 20 years, I've been a waif for 20 years. Thereat began a feeble scratching outside, and the pile of books moved as if thrust forward. I tried to jump up, but could not stir a limb, and so yelled aloud in a frenzy of fright. Mr. Lockwood's yell awakens Heathcliff, who enters with his natural antagonism. But as he hears his guest's explanation and the name of Catherine Earnshaw and the visitation from her ghost, a change passes over Heathcliff. I stood still and was witness involuntarily to a piece of superstition on the part of my landlord which belied oddly his apparent sense. He got onto the bed and wrenched open the lattice, bursting, as he pulled at it, into an uncontrollable passion of tears. "Come in, come in," he sobbed. "Cathy, do come. Oh, do once more. Oh, my heart's darling, hear me this time. Catherine, at last!" The spectre showed a spectre's ordinary caprice. It gave no sign of being, but the snow and the wind whirled wildly through, even reaching my station and blowing out the light. There was such anguish in the gush of grief that accompanied this raving that my compassion made me overlook its folly, and I drew off, half angry to have listened at all and vexed at having related my ridiculous nightmare, since it produced that agony, though why was beyond my comprehension. At daybreak, Mr. Lockwood is soon on his way back to his home at Thrushcross Grange, not wishing to stay at Wuthering Heights any longer than needed. When he returns, he relays his impressions of Mr. Heathcliff to his housekeeper, Nellie Jean. She begins to explain her own part in the history of the mysterious Catherine. Nellie had once lived at Wuthering Heights herself, growing up alongside the Earnshaw children, Hindley and Catherine, whilst her mother nursed them. One day, Mr. Earnshaw departs on business to Liverpool, and on his return, he brings with him something that will doom the fates and fortunes of every life in the home. Heathcliff. Young, feral, and dark, he has all the bearings of a gypsy. But Mr. Earnshaw is affectionate towards the young lad, which fosters bitter feelings from Hindley, who feels his rightful attention as the eldest son is being denied to him. These two become sworn enemies, but from the very beginning, young Catherine adores Heathcliff. They spend their days wandering the moors in childish mischief. The years press on, and before Hindley goes away to study, Mr. Earnshaw makes him swear that he will look after Heathcliff once he is gone. Mr. Earnshaw dies sometime later, passing peacefully with Catherine singing at his side. But when Hindley returns, he does not keep his promise. Heathcliff, once his father's favourite, is reduced to the status of servant. But Heathcliff ably endures this slight, seeing as he's still able to enjoy his time with Cathy. One day, Heathcliff and Cathy are up to their usual games and spying on the civilised Linton family in their home at Thrushcross Grange, the same house that Mr. Lockwood now resides in as tenant. Alarmed by the trespassers, the Linton's dog sets upon young Cathy, and she and Heathcliff are brought inside to see her wound. But the Lintons look down on the unkempt Heathcliff with revulsion and send him on his way. Whilst Cathy stays recovering, the Lintons cultivate her appearance into an elegant and sophisticated young lady, though she remains wild at heart. On the passing of Mr. Earnshaw, Hindley had become the master of the house, though great tragedy befalls him as he loses his wife during childbirth. Though she is able to deliver him his only son, Hareton, before she passes away, Hindley's depression strikes deep and he becomes an alcoholic. After spending time with the Lintons, Cathy begins to fall in love with their son, Edgar. He is gentlemanly, stable, and has great prospects for the future. But ever doubt gnaws at young Cathy as she confides in Nellie. Today, Edgar Linton has asked me to marry him, and I've given him an answer. Now, before I tell you whether it was a consent or denial, you tell me which it ought to have been. Really, Miss Catherine, how can I know? I replied. To be sure, considering the exhibition you performed in his presence this afternoon, I might say it'd be wise to refuse him. Since he asked you after that, he must be either hopelessly stupid or a venturesome fool. If you talk so, I won't tell you any more, she returned peevishly, rising to her feet. I accepted him, Nellie. Be quick and say whether I was wrong. You accepted him? Then what good is it discussing the matter? You have pledged your word and cannot retract. But say whether I should have done so. Do, she exclaimed in an irritated tone, chafing her hands together and frowning. Cathy insists that her love for Edgar is genuine, so why does she complain about her unhappiness? Your brother will be pleased. The old lady and gentleman will not object, I think. You will escape from a disorderly, comfortless home into a wealthy, respectable one. And you love Edgar, and Edgar loves you. All seems smooth and easy. Where is the obstacle? I've no more business to marry Edgar Linton than I have to be in heaven. And if the wicked man in there had not brought Heathcliff so low, I shouldn't have thought of it. It would degrade me to marry Heathcliff now. So he will never know how I love him, and that not because he's handsome, Nellie, but because he's more myself than I am. Whatever our souls are made of, his and mine are the same thing, and Linton's is as different as a moonbeam from lightning or frost from fire. But Heathcliff overhears only the worst of this conversation and is overwhelmed with betrayal upon hearing that Cathy sees marriage to him as degrading. He flees Wuthering Heights for many years, and Cathy falls ill with despair for the first time. She can do nothing but accept Edgar's marriage proposal. So she moves to Thrushcross Grove as Mrs. Catherine Linton. There she lives with her husband, his sister Isabella, and a lifelong confidant and servant, Nellie. The house is a haven of order and affection, though shadows linger in Catherine's restless spirit. Then, one evening, Heathcliff returns, tall, athletic, darkly handsome, his rough edges polished by mysterious wealth and travels. Edgar Lington begrudgingly invites him into his home.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.